Way up in Harlem at a table for two. There was four of us.
This is Glad Trad 8.2 with Rockin' Kiss. Here in Chicago. Today we're going to be talking mostly to Rock about his conversion to the Catholic faith and his work for the Catholic Church. Rock, welcome back.
Hey, Padre, how are you?
Doing well, thanks.
Good.
So would you tell us about your upbringing and your conversion to the Catholic faith?
What time is it? It's...
time here. 23:34. We're 11:34 p.m. here in Chicago.
Chicago. Nice. It's about 70 degrees. Been sitting out here smoking cigars, right?
Cigars.
Drinking.
What's my favorite whiskey here?
Right there. I don't even know.
The Balvenie.
Right. Drinking a beautiful scotch. Neat, of course. Just enjoying each other's company. Talking.
Are hermits allowed to have scotch and cigars?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. So, you know, so it's...
Wait, let's talk about your dog real quick here.
Okay.
Your dog that was nipping at my heels, that's a full pit bull.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the pedigree.
And this, you know what? This will come in later in the conversation. He's a triple bred grand champion Virgil with the mountain man Homer Outcross. So he is built for war. He's parabellum. You know, he's,
That's Latin for war.
Yep. There you go. And that's what, you know. And again, I think a lot of stuff that we see each other talk regularly, or you're coming to town, or we all go somewhere. You know, one of the things I think you and I always hone in on is the idea that Catholic men are supposed to be warriors. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. The idea of the warrior monk, you know.
Yeah.
The Templars, the Hospitallers, you know, the... You know,
I dream of those days.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, fighting for the glory of God, you know, is what we're supposed to be built for.
Yeah, and we're going to talk later in this podcast just about rescue of mm-hmm. Christians from Muslims, and it's going to be fascinating with your background as someone who'd dabbled or fully entered into Islam.
dabbled.
More than dabbled, right? And I believe that there's a desire for that. I mean, when St. Ignatius of Loyola formed the Jesuits with this military mm-hmm. model, and, mm-hmm. and the first thing they were going to conquer was themselves.
Themselves, absolutely. There we go. Right.
That's the phrase of the early Jesuits. I mean, unfortunately, like every Jesuit high school has taken the motto of men for others. But I have a Jesuit friend, he says, really, we shouldn't highlight the men for others in a time of so much like socialism and horizontal theology. We really right. should get back to this theology of conquer yourselves, because when people followed the theology of St. Ignatius of Loyola, I think by the end of the 16th century, there was either 50,000 or 100,000 men who had joined this. And it was mm-hmm. sort of like Shackleton's adventure. It was like, yeah, you're probably going to get sent to a place where you're going to get cut alive by spoons. Do you want to sign up? Yep, sign up.
I'm on it.
50 to 100,000 people. Or the Mercedarians. I mean, my dream would be to resuscitate mm-hmm. an order of Mercedarians, a group of men who would farm themselves out in ransom for either the unborn or sex slave trafficked kids, something like that. You know, people say, well, that was good for the Middle Ages. I mean, the current Mercedarians, with all respect to them, they go to nursing homes now saying that that's the new people that have to be served. How about the fact we have more slaves in the world than the transatlantic slave trade? The world is ripe for a group of monk warriors, of Mercedarians who actually farm themselves out in ransom. And the funny thing is, if you look at just the fascination, I was telling you earlier before we were recording, Rock, about this book I'm reading, Can't Hurt Me, mm-hmm. by the Navy SEAL who was running on broken shins, David Goggins. So many men right now are willing to just break their bodies for themselves. That's mm-hmm. the whole point of David Goggins is how to basically be a great person for yourself.
For yourself,
but
right.
the saints wanted to be these great people that broke their bodies for Christ.
For Christ,
yeah,
for God.
For the
right.
salvation of souls.
For our church, right.
And I really believe we're in a time, if bishops would give the green light to certain religious orders like this, even though there'd be a big risk and, you know, saying yes to Knights Hospitality or, mm-hmm. you know, people who would go in and rescue Muslims and stuff. And unfortunately, there are lay groups of Mercedarians, your friends in Spain, who go mm-hmm. out and they have automatic weapons and they rescue Christians in Africa who've mm-hmm. been kidnapped by Muslims, kind of giving a preview for some of the things we're going to talk about here.
So let me back up a little bit. I'd finally come to a place where life seemed to have some meaning.
Mm.
I was not Catholic, or I was not practicing I'll explain that later, because I had been baptized, even though I've been a practicing Muslim almost my entire life. You know, but young man, beautiful wife, she was pregnant. And I remember the first time when we went to the doctor, I think she might have been three months, my child in her womb. And we went to the doctor, and all I wanted to do was see an ultrasound. I didn't even know you couldn't see an ultrasound at 3 months, you know, or 2 months or whatever. You know, all I wanted to do was see an ultrasound and figure out if it was a boy or a girl. I remember sitting across from these two women, my wife and the doctor. And the doctor had this clipboard with, I don't know, 10 sheets of questions that she was asking my wife. It was our first visit. You know, how old were you when you had your first period? Any histories of ovarian cancer? Just regular medical stuff. So the two women were sitting across from each other, maybe 10 feet across from each other. And I was sitting in the corner of the room, just kind of like a fly on the wall, you know. All I wanted to do was figure out when I was going to see that ultrasound, you know. And they went through this and it was going on and on and on and on. And finally she got to the last sheet. And I think the second to last question was, if there was a problem with the pregnancy, would you consider terminating? Again, it was just a checklist of questions. It was our first visit. Doctor was getting medical history. And you know, it was pretty rote. But second to last question, if there was a problem with the pregnancy, would you consider terminating? And my wife looked up at the doctor and said, absolutely not. Whatever God gives us is what he gives us. And there was this, no pun intended, pregnant pause. There was this pause between, and these two women were just staring at each other. Mm. They were like locked eye to eye. Mm. I had no idea what was going on, but I clearly got the sense that this doctor did not appreciate or approve of my wife's answer. Again, I didn't know. I was not pro-life. The way I was living, Padre, I was pretty much anti-life. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't register to me anything except that the doctor was pissed off at my wife, and my wife was staring her down, and it was what it was.
Holding her ground.
Yes. Outside of that, I had no reference point to what was going on. So, you know, we finish up, pack up, go, and, you know, the days turn into weeks, and the weeks turn into months, and my wife's starting to show, and we finally get ready for the first ultrasound, and we go in, and, you know, I didn't know what to expect. Squeeze the gel, put it on her tummy, do the little thing, find the heartbeat, and I remember the image when it flashed up on the screen. And it was this little bitty person. It was clearly a person. She had to be like 4 months, 4 and a half, 5 months, maybe. And it was this little person floating around in there. And to this day, I swear he gave me the finger, you know. But he was, there's his feet, his head. Mm. It's a boy? Really? Wow. You know, and my heart, looking at that, listening to his heartbeat, my heart was overwhelmed. It felt like it was gonna burst out of my chest. Now, up until that point, the only person I really ever can honestly, truly say I loved was my wife. You know, coming from a background of, you know, inner city life, yeah, all that BS, you know. I'm trying to watch what I'm saying, because obviously I've got people I've got to respect and protect. But, you know, drug dealing, guns, dog fighting, I had no respect for life. I had no concept of respect for life. Yeah. Life as an inherent good. You know, I mean, there may have been individuals that I had.
Life was competition for you, that if your life was more valuable, there was no problem.
There was no problem.
Yeah.
No problem. And this is the first time that I ever felt an overwhelming love for, outside of my wife, for someone or something. And I was absolutely overwhelmed with joy and love at looking at my son floating around in my wife's womb, and walked out of there a changed man. I was not pro-life. That wasn't on my radar. That wasn't in my vocabulary. But I know what I saw. And fast forward a couple months. Now we're doing the Tarantino thing. Yeah. Where I'm back to the get this call one night. And again, it was rainy. It was dark. And my wife said the doctor called. And the doctor said that there was a 99.9% chance he was going to be severely deformed and handicapped. Now, when someone says 99.9, they mean it is what it is. It's 100%, right? I get home. I'm going to stop what I'm doing. Rush home. I get to her. And, you know, after an hour, she finally calmed down and explained to me that she was at work. At the time, she was working. And the doctor called. And the doctor said, you know, I have to tell you this. This test A, B, and C came back okay, but test X, Y, and Z came back not too good. Mm. And the diagnosis is you've got a problem. And my wife said, why in the world are you calling me at whatever, 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening on a Friday and telling me this on the phone? Why did you not call us into the office? Why did you not? And the doctor said to her, hey, basically, you told me if there was a problem, you guys weren't going to do anything. I wasn't even going to tell you this, but I felt ethically I had to, as a, you know.
How many months pregnant was she again?
At this point, 7 and a half.
Wow.
But that's when it first clicked to me. I went back to that first meeting when they had, but that we all had, when the doctor and her were locking eyes, and then I realized, we said we weren't going to do anything. And the doctor was like, hey, you guys said you weren't going to do anything, but I have to tell you, this is what it is, you know.
Was abortion a temptation at 7 and a half months when you heard that?
Well, so what happened after I got her calmed down and finally she went to sleep, so I don't know, it's 11 o'clock at night. I went in my little bitty office at the time, little cubbyhole, little man cave, and I sat there and I was staring at the wall. Padre, I'm looking at the wall like, yo, this is crazy. In a matter of a couple of hours, my entire life, upside down, boom. 3 hours ago, I was the happiest man on earth. Beautiful wife, got a son on the way. He'll be here soon. 3 hours later, hey, your son's going to be down. So, again, I said this in the last podcast. I said in this one, you're a man, I'm a man. You know how we do. All right, if there's a problem, how do we fix it? So I sat there looking at the wall for hours. I said, okay, what are my options? As a man, our go-to is let's assess the situation and figure out what we're going to do to fix it.
That's right.
But in order to assess the situation, you need to lay out what your options are. What's my first option? All right. He's going to be born. He's going to be okay. What does that mean? Was it a miracle? I don't believe in miracles. Were the doctors wrong? They said it's 99.9%. Yeah. So, all right. Maybe he's going to be born. He's going to be okay. But that's off the table. All right. Because it's off the table. What's my next option? He's going to be born. He's going to be sick. He's going to be deformed. He's going to be handicapped. All right, what would my old man have done? He would have taken care of me.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that's an option. All right, I can be a man. I can do what a man's supposed to do. This is in front of me. This is laid before me. This is what I have to face. I can spend my entire life taking care of this deformed child. So what does that mean? I'm like, all right, well, that means no. All these plans I have for my future and what I wanted to build and what I wanted to do, all that's in the garbage can, you know. Traveling and all this, none of that's going to, it's just not a factor anymore.
Of course.
I'm going to have to spend my life taking care of my kid. Okay, that's option number two. What's option number three? We're going to board them, start again.
Yep.
Now, again, I'm not saying which path I was choosing.
These are just the assessments.
These are the options. He's born and he's cool. He's born and my life is not what I thought it was going to be.
Yep.
Or he's not born and I don't have that problem. And we go again. So those are the three options.
Yep.
And as soon as I said to myself that third option, you know what I realized? If we got an abortion, I'd be murdering my own son. I have never, ever, 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 ever thought of that. You know me. You've known me for years. Yeah. Obviously not now. I'm attempting to live a Catholic life, but you know, breaking the jaw or hurting somebody was not that. Again, I mean, life had no meaning outside of what I gave it.
That's right.
You know, whether it be my life or your life.
Yep.
And at that moment, again, and it sounds crazy in retrospect, but at the time, there was no standard. There was no bar. So when I said to myself, if I go route three, that means I would be murdering my own child, my own son, not just my own son.
That's right.
I had seen, I was looking at his ultrasound picture on the wall, hanging on the wall. And at that moment, I broke down. I hadn't probably cried in maybe 20 some years. I remember crying going to boot camp. Like, yo, what did I get myself into? I remember crying when I got married. Just like, wow, this is cool. My wife's beautiful. But in terms of crying for the hurt of even thinking of something so vile, you know, and this might have been now 1 o'clock in the morning.
Did you believe in God at this point?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No. I didn't believe anything except for what I wanted,
wow.
You know.
Wow.
But I did believe that thing, that zygote, that whatever they want to call it, that lump, clump, said whatever they want to call it,
that deformed baby,
right? That was a baby, and it was my baby.
Yeah.
He was my son, my firstborn son. And I went online. I don't know why I started looking up the various tests that they had given my wife to determine that he was going to be, you know, sick. And obviously, because they give these, a lot of women, you know, they get. A lot of these genetic tests,
mm-hmm.
and if they find out the kids have Down syndrome or whatever, they abort the kids.
It's always a death sentence. Well,
right.
95% of the time, it's a death sentence from the amniocentesis.
Exactly, all of them. Right, and they gave her all of these tests without her knowledge because she did not want them to do it. So as I'm looking up these tests, naturally, they're linked to stuff about abortion because when they give these tests and they find the kids have these genetic markers, abortions generally the next step.
95% of the time.
Yep. So I didn't go looking for abortion. I was looking at these, looking up these, you know, these tests. But they kept linking me to, or I kept, you know, getting reference links to stuff about abortion.
100%.
And I clicked on a picture, and I'm sure you've seen the pictures that the hand with the dime. And the little baby to show that even at this early stage, he has fingers and his arms and, you know.
You came across that then?
Yeah, I did. I did. And I'm like, excuse my language, Padre. I was like, what the F? You know, I kept looking. And somehow I came on a link for Priest for Life, Father Frank Pavone. You know, obviously his charism is like.
No, he's a good man.
Yours, right.
Yeah.
Pro-life, human dignity. And I'd been looking, not so now, it's maybe 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, this is, you know.
You're still up same night.
Same night, right. I'm exhausted. I'm in a daze.
You stared at a wall for 2 hours.
Right. And I'm looking at the websites about these various genetic tests, and then I'm looking, and those link me over to stuff about abortion, and then I find this link to Father Frank Pavone's site. And somewhere in there, there was a link in his site to Humanae Vitae. Now, I don't know why, you know. Well, let me back up a little bit. At this point, this is when, again, around the time when John Paul II was dying. Mm-hmm. And one thing I had always noticed, I was vehemently anti-Catholic. All right. I grew up believing Catholics worship Mary, the Pope, the Antichrist, all of that stuff. I mean, part of Islam. I mean, you know, that's what it is. But the one thing I did notice, or I was keenly aware of, is that, and this is before the homosexual juggernaut became what it is now. This is earlier on.
Or was there any to know about it?
No, no. I mean, I knew about it. It just didn't have the grip gotcha. That it has now.
Right, right.
But I did notice that even though I thought Catholics, again, were infidels and all of that, the one thing I did give the Catholic Church some degree of respect for is that in what we call the culture wars, mm-hmm. Catholics always seem to be the only ones that like stand up to the homosexual movement. I'm saying even back then,
mm-hmm.
I didn't really know anything about John Paul II, except he was the Pope, which made him one of the Antichrist, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
But I was keenly aware that anytime anything came up in the UN or there, it was always the church. And I'm saying not individual church men, but the church, the Catholic Church always seemed to fall on the right side of specifically the homosexual question. And that, in my mind, I always gave the church modium of respect for that.
That was clear to you.
Right. That one thing was clear. Like, you know, everyone else obfuscated or enough pressure got put on and they would change their, you know, their line of reasoning. But the church always seemed to stand on that one issue. And that did stick in my mind. That did stick in my mind.
I never knew that.
So I get to Humana Vitae.
3 a.m.
At 3 a.m. And I don't know why, but I decided to read it. I don't know why. And I read the entire thing, and I was stunned because, again, this is whatever the mid-2000s, yep. and the stuff he was writing was in the mid-late '60s.
Mm-hmm.
But everything he hit on, contraception, women pornography, women become the natural end result of these abortion, all of the natural end result of these things being what we're living through now. Again, I didn't have a reference point. I didn't know this was written 30 years before. For all I knew, it sounded like he wrote this 2 weeks ago. But that, having read that, and then at this point, again, I'm so exhausted and I'm so in a different place. I read it once and something in the back of my mind said, you know, this is something's odd here. This is too perfect. Meaning from a, I guess what we would call a natural law perspective, it all made sense. It wasn't about quoting the Bible because you know what, as a Muslim, I quote the Quran to you all day. Doesn't matter because you don't believe in the Quran, right? So the reverse is true. You can talk to me about the Bible all you want.
But you just saw these things coming true.
It was airtight. Yeah. It was airtight. Yep. It was airtight. There was not a fallacy or flaw, a fissure in any of the concepts that he was expounding upon in that encyclical. And that right there is, I think, for me, the defining moment when I, for whatever reason, and I will humbly call it grace, that I decided to look at the Catholic Church as being a possibility for what I did not know.
And here it's 4 a.m., 5 a.m., sun's about to come up.
Right.
You're dealing with the worst news you've ever heard in your life, and then an encyclical that you find prophetic.
Moved me to, and again, this wasn't an overnight thing. This wasn't a road to Damascus moment.
Well, I'm just saying like that.
No, but it was a small break that allowed me. That was the first time I was really willing to say, okay, you know what? Let me look at this again. Wow. You know, so needless to say, the baby that was 99.9% deformed and turned out to be Porter. Now, you know P. You know my man Porter, right? This dude is, he's what is he, in the ninth grade now.
He's built like a fire hydrant.
Right. The cat is a varsity wrestler, varsity track. He's fluent in German. You know, he hangs out. He's a Ranger, Navy SEAL, little mascot.
Serves the Latin Mass. He's at an Opus Dei High School.
Oh, yep, right. And every day I look at this kid, I realize that his life could have been ended by my own hand if I made that third choice. Now, again, she and I never had a discussion about this. We never had a debate. It was never on the table as a topic to be discussed.
So when he was born, were you expecting him to come out very deformed?
No. I don't know what I was expecting.
You didn't care because you loved him.
Right.
Yep.
And again, you know him. You've known him for years. I mean, he's, you know, what every father would wish for in his son.
Absolutely.
Handsome kid, yes. Smart, you know, aggravating, goofy, tough, you know.
He's a great kid.
And my heart goes out to, and my respect goes out to those fathers who raise their families. And if their family has a child or two that are, you know, have issues,
yeah.
You know, the type of sacrificial love,
that's right.
You know, is something that I've, that degree is not something that I've been called to do. But again, it speaks to our inherent strength as Catholic men, you know.
Tell us a bit about before that. I mean, whatever you feel comfortable with sharing. You were baptized Catholic, left that because your dad is a Muslim.
Right.
And then you led a violent life.
Right. And, you know, it's funny because we you know, when I decided to again, my mother was Catholic, was raised Catholic, born Catholic, but nominal. I mean, again, not practicing like that, but was baptized. And
you grew up in New York?
Yes, between New York and Cleveland. And I moved here, the early 90s? I've been here longer than I've been anywhere else, but.
Still got that New York accent, though.
Do I?
Yeah, he said qual at the time.
So the, you know, I was baptized as an infant, but I was raised I grew up as a Muslim, and you know, I mean, there's something to be said for, you know, Islam is, and I'm not really sure who would be offended by this. I really don't care. Islam is from the devil.
Yeah,
all right, Islam, we do not worship the same God.
Absolutely.
In other words,
Catholics don't worship the same God as Muslims.
As Muslims, absolutely.
I agree with you, Rob.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
And anyone that says otherwise either is lying or they don't know what they're talking about. Because the whole idea of God having a son is, or God being born of a virgin, that even though Muslims believe in, and I air quotes, believe in Jesus or air quotes, believe in Mary, the idea that God took flesh or that God was born of a woman is blasphemy to a Muslim. Blasphemy.
And the notion that God is Father is blasphemy to
a Muslim. No, even, exactly. The fact that the idea that God has a relationship with you.
That's right.
Is blasphemy.
He's pure transcendent, nothing immanent in Islam.
Pure power.
Yeah.
That's why.
Will to power that's capricious.
Absolutely. And in Islam, if God wanted to say up is down and down is up.
That's right.
He can do it. Because it's his will.
If he tells you to fly an airplane into the World Trade Center, you do it.
Because it's his will.
Yeah.
And that's why, and again, let's qualify what we're talking about. We're not talking about Muslims necessarily as individuals. We're talking about Islam as
Absolutely. A
false theology. Right?
Absolutely.
Because I'm going to tell you, I know far more devout Muslims than I know devout Catholics.
Oh, they take it seriously. I mean, that's
right.
And men take that faith seriously.
And that's what I was going to, that's exactly the point I was going to get to, is that one of the things, you know, I saw growing up, you know, manly men, hardcore men, you know, men willing to die for something, being Islam.
You went to the mosques in Brooklyn or what?
Yeah. All over the country. I mean, you know, our ties were pretty deep. But the fact that I saw men willing to give and to lose for something that they believed in, you know, made a profound mark on me. And I think maybe that is what helped me to develop a love for the appreciation for priests like you.
Mm.
To be willing to give and to die for something that on a natural level doesn't make sense. It's not about your personal benefit. You know, I see you, Father. Look, known you for years, right? You know, the amount of time that you spend helping other souls. I have two kids and a wife and a dog, a couple businesses, and I'm overwhelmed. I'm 18, 20 hours a day deep. But again, at the end of the day, you know, I mean, obviously my wife, my first obligation is to get to heaven and to get my wife and my children to heaven. But so much of what I do is a benefit to me, you know, and to see, you know, men living their lives for something other than themselves and greater than themselves, which I try to emulate as a father. But what you emulate or what you live out as a father with a capital F is obviously inspirational. And I know this sounds cheesy, but it's a standard. It's a standard in which, you know, every lay Catholic man, you know, needs to live by. You know?
Thanks, Rakim. That means a lot. I want to get back to that mm-hmm. topic on Islam mm-hmm. with discipline, though. I mean, I think that's so interesting that what you saw in these men was discipline. And even though it's a system, I mean, I think that's a big debate. Is Islam just a system or is it a religion? We won't jump into that tonight because mm-hmm. it's about midnight here in Chicago. But it is interesting that you saw men living discipline. And I think that's why Catholics become Muslim is because
absolutely.
There's no loopholes, there's no games. It's just what you see is what you get.
And that's why traditionalism is going to be our savior with a lowercase s of the faith. It's men are not, you know, my wife was joking about, you know, listening to these sappy homilies from these effeminate guys and these girls all over the altar. And when you go to the Tridentine Mass, you see military precision, you see rubrics, you see, you know, it speaks to a man's soul. That's right. How we're made, you know, and that is what, you know, in a very, very fallen state, Islam gives to right. a lot of people that
right.
you know, at least gives to men
right.
is, you know, an ordered sense of the world.
I think right. order is the key. I mean, and that's what's so different about the dogma and liturgy nowadays as it was 100 years ago in the church is there's order to mm-hmm. it. And I think people, you know, when I was kind of more of a charismatic Catholic, I think the idea of order made me think of, oh, that's just kind of like German Catholicism mm-hmm. of the 1950s.
Stifling or whatever.
Yeah, stifling. Right. But if you really think about it, I mean, St. Paul, who spoke in tongues, raised the dead, worked miracles, he was establishing a faith of order mm-hmm. at the same time. And tongues and stuff, I just don't think it really came into the Mass he was offering. I mean, there's mm-hmm. paraliturgical mm-hmm. worship where there's room for that stuff. But it doesn't belong in the liturgy and it doesn't belong in dogma because we have an airtight system.
Airtight system, right.
Catholicism that, again, men are attracted to because they don't want to hear emotions till the cows come
mm-hmm.
home.
Mm-hmm.
Men need a system that is ordered and airtight. And when you go to the Latin Mass, you mentioned that there's something militaristic about it. And again, 20 years ago, I would have said that's precisely why I don't like the Latin Mass. But now when I see that God is a God of order, if you study like, yep. you know, we're in your backyard here, you were showing me this beautiful tree that you guys planted. If you look at a veined leaf on there, if you think of the amount of order and the cascades mm-hmm. of proteins and just the DNA mm-hmm. structure of a single leaf there,
right.
I mean, the order that's required to make the tree that's behind you, certainly the Mass needs mm-hmm. more order than that. Certainly yeah. our the dogma of the Catholic Church needs that. And so it's interesting that you, as a man who lived decades as a Muslim, finds, I don't want to say comfort in traditional Catholicism, but it just makes sense.
It makes sense.
You don't have time for the games of emotions.
Right, and we can call it comfort. We can call it synchronicity between, you know, again, I mean, you know when something's right. You know, you may not be able to articulate a concept yet, but you know when it's right when it's right, you know. And, you know, I go all over the world and, you know, I don't care where we're at. You know, when it's time for Salat, your five daily prayers, Muslims will be in Paris and they'll stop in the middle of the street, cabbies and buzzer, whoever. Them guys will get down on their mat and make Salat five times. They don't care where they're at. They don't care who's around. They don't care who's looking. You know, this is, I mean, for them, this is Islam. This is, you know, and if we as Catholic men had 1/100th of their vigor, man, we could take the world back over again.
That's right. And just fearlessness in proclaiming the faith. Like when we were in that Russian restaurant in the Loop today, you mentioned to me how you want to do the sign of the cross as big as possible, and you have your family do the sign of the cross as big as possible, because we're not ashamed about this faith.
Right.
And that's the problem, is we become so ashamed for this faith, where you're absolutely right. Muslims are not ashamed for their faith.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and that goes back to what we talk about, like the cassock and the collar, and, you know, the idea that, listen, man, you know, it is what it is, and this is what we are, you know, and that's why I respect you, you know, when we're out together and you're wearing your cassock, you know, we joke, you know, hey, my son and I, or Corey and the fellas, a joke, you know, yeah, we dare somebody to say something to Padre, we dare someone to say something out the side of their mouth,
the only reason I'm afraid going out in my cassock with you, Rock, is I'm afraid the 9mm is going to get busted out.
Bro, if that's what has to happen, that's what has to happen, you know.
If someone were to rip on me.
Yeah, right, right.
That's my only fear.
No doubt, but you know.
I'd be like, don't hurt him, Rock, no.
But you know what, look at the bright side, you're there to give him his last rites, so, you know, maybe it's a win-win for this guy, you know. No, sure. But the idea, again, that we be proud of being Catholic, you know.
That's right.
That we be proud of what we are, what Christ has given us, yeah. You know. And again, it's awkward at times, because we're trying to be proud of something that's been so deformed. Not the faith, not the dogma,
right.
But the human institution, that's the human right. Part of it, you know.
Yeah.
You know, how many times do you have to sit there and break down and discuss and explain, not the faith, but why real priests aren't homosexual predators? You know, you spend so much time.
I mean, the purification through this great apostasy is making that proverbial remnant a lot quicker than we realize.
Right.
You know, and I think that someone even said the church fathers had this line where they said the last Christians won't be able to fast a day or vigil one night, but they will be greater than all the rest for the spiritual attack they'll be under. And I just can't help but think, you know, this is today. Now, I respect the fact, Rakim, you can't talk about all your paramilitary involvement, but as a man who is, you know, a devout Muslim for years and now is someone who wants to rescue, and not just wants to, but is involved in groups that help rescue Christians from Muslims, that's quite a 180. Can you tell us a little bit about that without endangering your comrades there?
Right. So, I mean, it's not, you know, we do, one of the companies that I do own or founded is basically a private military contracting company. And, yes, I'm very proud of the fact that a number of our teams have been involved in, you know, rescuing Nigerian girls from Boko Haram, beasts that, you know, remember a couple of years ago, those 200 schoolgirls that were kidnapped.
Yep.
One of our teams was boots on the ground. You know, they found 70 something of the girls. And again, I mean, this goes to, it goes back to the whole warrior monk, or even the knights that weren't obviously, you know, ordained or clergy. They still, you know, lived lives of, you know, they took certain vows, and depending on what the order was, you know, took various vows that, I don't want to say mimic, replicated in step with with a number of vows that you take as a priest, you know.
That's right.
And again,
I'll jump in there real quick. The Superior General of the Mercedarians. Well, let me just talk about the Mercedarians and Trinitarians for a minute. From 1200 to 1800, these two orders would go and rescue them. So they would ransom them either through money. They would give a third of their tithe to buying Christian slaves back from Muslims, or farm themselves out.
All for themselves.
Yep. That's right.
Yep.
And what's incredible is the Superior General of the Mercedarians and or the Trinitarians, I think both orders, and by the way, they actually rescued 900,000. When I first started reading about the Mercedarians and Trinitarians, I thought, oh, they must have got a couple hundred.
A handful, right.
Yeah. From 1200 to 1900, they rescued 900,000 Christians who had been taken captive by Muslims. We're talking like, you know, on the border of Spain and Morocco, people who were kidnapped from Spain or France and taken into Morocco or Algeria. In any case, the Superior General of the Mercedarians was the chief ransomer. In other words, he had to be the very first to offer himself. Exactly,
right.
For maybe they find out about some Christian mom and girl who were taken slaves by Muslims in Algeria. He had to be the first to farm himself out in ransom. I mean, how far of a cry is that from our current situation
right.
Of the higher you are, the more
untouchable,
right, and
unapproachable.
Exactly.
Or, right,
and
right.
Just, you know, you're living in your
$6 million
Yeah, and it's like
mansion, right.
What an imitation of Christ that the right. Superior of an order had to be the first to go become a slave, literally a slave to Christ,
right.
for Muslims.
And let's clarify something, all right? We talked about earlier that Muslims and Catholics do not worship the same God.
Yep.
The idea of a moderate Muslim is the same. A moderate Muslim is equivalent to a cafeteria Catholic.
That's right.
Okay, so you got people who claim to be Catholics, but they'll pick and choose. And that's exactly what a moderate Muslim is. So, again, we're not talking about Muslims as individuals. We're not necessarily talking about Catholics as individuals. We're talking about the truth, our church founded by God, versus this false religion from, as Father Isaac says, Father Isaac Mary Relier, this false religion from hell, you know.
Yep.
You know, so we are at war. We are again. I've been on both sides, so I'm telling you, Islam is not about dialogue. Islam is not about meeting you halfway.
Yeah.
Islam is, this is Allah's will. This is there's no quarter to be given.
That's right.
Now tactics may change. You know, Islam may purport to be.
They'll kiss your hand until they can cut it off, percentage-wise, in a population.
Exactly.
Right?
Absolutely. That's what I was going to say.
Muslims are 1% in the population. They'll kiss your hand. Once you're
51%, they're
going to cut it off.
It's a different... Exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly where I was going. So, you know, where atheism and communism falls into this great battle between God and the devil versus where Islam is versus where paganism and nihilism, you know... again, how they all align, they're all on that side, we're on this side.
Yeah.
And I think it's heartbreaking that we don't understand the war that we're in.
That's
you
right.
Know?
In the Middle Ages, there was no
question.
No, there was
right.
no ecumenical talk on this stuff.
Right.
You know, it just hit me. It's after midnight here in Chicago. We're having whiskey and cigars. This was not planned in my podcast with you, but it just hit me. I mean, you went from a couple decades as a Muslim to now running a paramilitary group to save Nigerian girls from Boko Haram. And hearing your story, I mean, you know, 4 years ago you told me in the parking lot the basics of reading Humana Vitae. But hearing the full conversion story tonight, it sounds like your decision not to abort your firstborn Porter, that was the pivot point. And
absolutely.
What a flip from being a Muslim to now rescuing Christians from Muslims. I really can't help but believe your decision for life was that pivot point. And, you know, my big dream is to resuscitate the Mercedarians. It probably never happened in my life, but I always see it as the, you know, the people who are most threatened in the world today are the unborn and the
sex-slave
girls.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so I always see those two as linked. Well, I just realized these two were linked for your life, in your life, that your decision for life, for unborn life, has also led to the rescuing of
it was clearly the catalyst for
yeah.
absolutely. And I'll say this, Padre, you know, you've been out with us
two, three times.
Shooting, you know, just messing around. And you're not that bad. You're pretty good on the M4. You're good on your Glock work. So, I think hopefully it happens sooner than later. And, I don't know about priests running around with an M4.
In the Middle Ages, the priest couldn't be armed. And I think the new code of canon law still holds that as far as, like, going into battle. But they were in the same battles as those who were armed.
Right.
You know, and that's where, please God, we can join forces somehow in the future.
Well, what I would suggest, though, is if you're ever out in the field with us and guns start going off, you know, make sure you hide behind Corey. You know how big Corey is? He's a really big target and stuff. So, you know, you just duck behind him, you know. No, just hold your cross up high, you know. But just get behind Corey. He'll take those rounds for you.
Corey will take the hits?
Yeah, he'll take the rounds for you. So, but outside of the Boko Haram, I'm just saying that's one thing that we are all very particularly proud about. It's not the only thing that we do. There's been other stuff. There's been several things that we're working on now. I think that hit particularly close to home, you know, the idea that it was such a huge, it had received so much press, not our actions, but the fact that those girls were captured, or kidnapped, I'm sorry, not captured, kidnapped, how much clearer does it need to be that our enemy, not our spiritual, but our spiritual enemy made manifest in man, is doing the type of harm and damage and carnage that they're doing, and we still haven't got the picture yet. You know?
And that's great that you recognize that, because the Muslims are deceived by the real enemy, who's Satan, and that's where, you know, we want them to convert, because their souls are infinitely valuable to God. Well, I guess only God's infinite, but exponentially more important to God than we realize. Did you know this? I've been told by both Catholics and evangelicals, 25% of the conversions in the Middle East of Muslims to Christianity is by private revelation. That Jesus and Mary are appearing at very high rates to Muslims in the Middle East right now.
And you know what? To piggyback on that, and that's what, you know, my wife mentions that one of the toughest, or as you call them, speed bumps in her conversion was our mother. And you can argue with a fallen away, when I say argue, you can reason a fallen away Catholic to the truth. Whether they accept it or not, that's not what I'm saying.
Right.
You can reason with a fallen away Catholic. You can reason with a lot of atheists, right? Based on natural law. In Islam, the conversion of Islam to the point of private revelations is going to be our mother.
Oh yeah.
And that's why I've embraced her. That was easy for me to embrace her.
Beautiful.
Because you can't reason, again, because Islam is founded not on, you know, natural law or reason.
Yeah.
You can't reason if it's not based on reason, right?
No, so you're right.
If it's based on just the arbitrary will of a entity that is more powerful than you, and we use the analogy, if Allah says up is down and down is up, that's what it is, you know.
And I'm sure you know this, but the Quran holds Mary to be perpetually virgin, not just virgin at the birth of Christ, but perpetually virgin, which is, and I have great evangelical friends who I've learned a lot from, but even Protestant communities don't have that high of a view of Mary. So I agree 100% with you that Mary's going to be the key to the conversion of Muslims. Did you know if you go to Fatima today, you'll actually see Muslims on pilgrimage?
Yeah, pilgrimage, right.
Yeah, tell us why you embrace Our Lady so closely.
Well, I mean, that was what, you know, I mean, outside the fact that I've had a very terrible relationship with my mother, and that she really filled that void for me. I mean, I think in a bigger sense, you know, the idea that, you know, it's going to be Mary that's going to, and what prophecy was that where it was going to be? I'm trying to think. It'll come to me because we've had a little too much whiskey and a few too many cigars. But it's been held and maybe I'll come back to you on another podcast.
I can probably tell you what apparition was.
Right. No, that Mary was going to be the one to convert Islam, Muslims in mass.
We'll have someone write it. Yeah, I mean, right. I can't remember what it was. In the 60s, there was the longest remaining private revelation in the history of the world at a Orthodox Coptic church in Cairo, where an image of Our Lady remained on the front of that church for like something like 10 years. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot happening right now.
In fact, I once met a Muslim.
And he grew up in an orphanage in Saudi Arabia. And I said to him, well, what did it? Like, what converted mm-hmm. you? And he said, well, when I was 10 years old, I watched Home Alone, which actually takes place like, a mile from here?
Yeah,
in Wilmette, right. We're in North Chicago. Right. He when he was an orphan in when he was an orphan in Saudi Arabia, he watched Home Alone. He saw the kid do the sign of the cross, and it haunted him for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
He wondered, what was that sign of the cross? He did research. He ended up getting a Bible in Arabic mm-hmm. 5 years later and still in this orphanage there. And when I heard that the catalyst for his entire conversion was just, you know, Kevin in Home Alone making a sign of the cross. It's like,
right. Wow,
God needs just this tiny crack in our hearts
exactly.
to just get in there and bring all of his grace and mercy.
The tiny crack in the heart and those willing to, you know, the fact that it was the sign of the cross.
Yeah.
It wasn't just the crack in his heart. Mm. There was something to fill that crack.
The mystery of the cross.
Right.
Everything comes down to the cross.
So again, the collar, the cassock. The Catholic families, the sign of the cross at before, you know, meal in a restaurant or those small things. And you and I talked about this a lot. We talk about this a lot. Like, you know, whether, you know, it's scorched earth policy or whether it's being more subtle and smooth in how we attract, you know, I mean, and the debate is open ended. I mean, you know, sure. I mean, we talk about it in terms of approach, but, you know, I think that, again, you know, here's something on the Trinity Mass. I remember, you know, in you know, I used to read encyclopedias, right, front to back, just read books, any and everything I could get my hands on. And I remember finding there was a box in the back of a closet somewhere, and I guess it were books that my mother used to have.
Mm-hmm.
And again, my mother was baptized as a Catholic, and there was a pink catechism. I remember getting it. It's this little pink book. And I might have been like 8 years old or something. And I started flipping through it and I started reading it. And I was absolutely, absolutely horrified and at the time disgusted with the idea of, like, you know, eating the body and blood of Jesus, right?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely horrified. But I'm flipping through this, I'm reading this catechism. Again, it was maybe a condensed Baltimore catechism.
Right.
It might have been like 50 pages,
right.
Pink cover. And I remember it had some illustrations. And I remember it was showing the priest.
Oh, like Baltimore catechism type illustrations?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. But it was, you know, it was probably written in the 50s. So the priest, you know, looked like Don Draper from Made Men or Mad Men, whatever, you know, just, you know, perfectly cut hair.
Absolutely.
And, you know, he's got the little two altar boys, the little blonde altar boys next to him. And, you know,
just like Legionnaires of Christ.
And I didn't think anything of it except that, this is kind of like why why we believe what we believe is Muslims. And this is apostasy and blah, 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 blah. But fast forward 25 years or 20 years, and, you know, when I read Humana Vitae and started exploring the church and started going to Novus Ordo Mass, the one thing that always stuck in my head was, this does not look like the pictures in that book.
Interesting.
That always stuck in my head.
Is that right?
Because the priest, in the illustrations, the priest were facing the altar, right? And
wow.
I remember.
You remember that 25 years later?
Yeah, I remember. It just kind of stuck in my head. Like every Novus Ordo Mass I went to, I was like, something doesn't click. And I remember the first time I went to the Tridentine Mass, man. Padre, I remember I was driving by, I was over in that area by St. John Cantius, and one of the guys that worked for me was like, hey, you know, because I used to read the catechism had my guy drive me around. I was reading the catechism, the new catechism. Mm-hmm. And one of my guys was like, hey, man, that's where they offer that, like, Latin stuff. And I was like, oh, really?
Mm.
Big, big, intimidating-looking, beautiful structure. And I was like, wow, okay, all right. So, you know, and all my guys knew I was, you know, I converted and was, you know, looking for, you know, I was going to, you know, Novus Ordo Mass and stuff. And I remember saying, okay, you know what? I'm going to take my son and we're going to go to this church. But I wanted to get ready for it. I knew it was a Tridentine. I didn't know it was called the Tridentine Mass. I knew it was the Latin. I knew it was the old school Mass, right? And I remember looking at videos online and ordering a bunch of books and trying to get, like, really ready for this thing because I thought it was going to be something so big and so, like, spectacular.
Yeah.
And I finally, after maybe 4 or 5 months, worked up the nerve to go to the Latin Mass. So son and I get our stuff together, put them in a little backpack, my little carry bag, right?
About.
And we off we went. And I remember it was like February. So you know how it is, the late winter when the sun is very specular, it's very sharp. It's not a muted light like it is in December or January. This is when it's, you know, the light is sharp.
Yeah.
The air is clear but cold. And I remember opening the front doors and walking in. Padre, the previous Mass had just ended, so there was still incense wafting through the...
Wow.
And the light was coming through the stained glass windows. And it was very sharp, very specular light. It was very sharp light. And I remember being absolutely overwhelmed at that moment. And I went and I sat in the corner. And Mass started. I had no idea what was going on. I had watched all these videos, read all these books, but I still didn't know what was going on. And it just all made sense in a way that you can't articulate.
Yep.
As my wife had mentioned, it was being someplace that was so above and beyond anything that I'd ever experienced. Look, Father, I've been all over the world. You know how we get down, right? We travel, we eat, we drive. To be in a place that was just so other than. And I think that is one of the things, again, we go back to talk about being fishers of men and attracting men to the, not men, just men, but men and women to the faith. Is, you know, like my wife said, you know, if you want to feel good, you know, hey, you're great and God loves you, you can get that from, you can watch Oprah and get that. You know what I'm saying? But to go someplace that you clearly know you are so small, but at the same time, you are everything to that God. You know, it's like.
Well, that's a great way to put it. That he would
be on the cross. So small and you're everything at the same
time. Absolutely. I mean, because Jesus said to several mystics, if you were the only person, I still would have gone through the cross for you.
Think about that.
Yeah. You know? And yet, what God said to St. Catherine of Siena, I am he who is and you are she who is nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's that paradox of that he would send his only son to die for each and every individual if they were the only person who ever sinned. And yet, we're just, you know, a puff of air without God. We're nothing without God. But it's interesting, just, you know, you talking about going into that place and seeing the incense. I mean, again, 20 years ago, I would have said that's Catholicism with embellishment. But now I realize, you know what? That is Catholicism without embellishment. What
with
I mean
essentials.
By, with essentials. And because, and here's the thing, Catholicism doesn't need embellishment because what God has embellished it with it through the centuries that we, again, called traditional Catholicism, but which I believe is just Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
What you saw when you stepped into that church that cold spring morning with the incense and the light coming through the stained glass, that was not Catholicism with embellishment. That was how God, through the centuries himself, has embellished us. And that's where that was a direct experience of God. It wasn't an experience of just piety.
Right.
It was a direct experience of God himself.
Right. I had no clue what was going on.
Yeah.
I could barely follow. But I knew that chant.
Yeah.
I knew the incense. I knew the investment. I knew. And again, this is not about, like, because I was going to, before you made that point, I was going to state that this is not about superficial, you know, it's not about surface gloss. It's just all integral, you know.
Yeah.
So this is not all about dressing well for Mass for its own sake. It's not about
incense
or beautiful vestments for their own sake. It's how it all ties together. And when it all ties together, you know it works. And again, if a man is cold-blooded and cold-hearted is me, and I'm a lowly man, I'm a bad man, I'm a sinful man, every day, any rosary, daily rosaries I offer, any sacrifice to make, I'm trying to get my ass to purgatory. You know what I'm saying? I know how small I am, you know, but
good man.
If a man as small as me can sense that this all works, you know,
and that's important that you sense, you know, you're a big black man in Chicago who makes a lot of money. The fact you walk into a church and you feel so small, that's important. When you walk into a church and the priest is just like, "Hey, everybody, wanted to congratulate you that the Bears won this weekend," you don't feel small.
No,
you feel, I'm a bigger Bears fan than you. Well, maybe not a Bears fan.
I got season tickets. What are you telling
me?
You're right.
I mean,
you know, right.
And it'd be more fun for me to be down at Soldier Field and for me to be listening to you make a joke about the Bears or something when Mass starts. Like, but when you walk into that St. John Cantius and you feel that small, that's necessary to worship God. And one more thing, you know, you mentioned it was hard for you to follow along. People say, "Well, I didn't understand Latin." It's like, do you understand everything about God? No, that's actually key. When people say to me, "I didn't get it all," or "I didn't follow it," or "I didn't get the Latin." Yeah, this is the mystery that the younger generations called, that they feel called to.
Exactly, exactly. And you know, and I hate it, it's a pet peeve, you know, when I hear somebody say, I can't, you know, follow along, and I'm looking at the missal, and I'm trying to read the English, and I'm trying to follow with that in Latin. And listen, man, I'm driving to my office downtown, and I see a woman in her mirror putting on makeup, driving, and listening to the radio at the same time, and combing her hair. Yeah, I'm not trying to hear all that. Listen, you know, we can multitask. We can do more than one thing. And the beauty, though, about the Tridentine Mass is all you have to do is be. Just give whatever it is you have to give. Offer up whatever it is you have to offer up.
That's right.
And, you know.
Yeah, the offertory. I always say that's the most underrated part of the Mass because that's where you offer your whole life. You know, Rocco, I'm out here because my grandma's dying out in Dixon. Mm-hmm. And she's almost 104. And when I met you, she had her 100th birthday. That's what I was doing in Chicago 4 years ago when I met you. And something I was just saying to my mom the other day is what was fascinating to me about my grandma and my grandpa when my grandpa was still alive, God rest his soul, he died about 15 years ago, is she was always, like, even in their 70s and 80s, I remember when I was a teenager, my last years visiting them, my grandma would still be surprised at my grandpa's humor and start giggling. And the fact that my grandpa in his 80s could still surprise my grandma made me realize marriage is this mystery where you haven't figured everything out. And the reason she was, you know, giggling and still in love as an 80-year-old is because there was a mystery in him she hadn't fully figured out, and there was a mystery in her that he hadn't
fully
figured out.
Figured out, right.
And so this whole idea that you have to know, like, every prayer the priest is praying and everything that's happening at Mass, how do you love something that's not a mystery?
And that's one reason I love the Latin
Mass is because the fact you don't get it all and that you're always discovering new layers. And that's just not the Mass. I mean, just the Catholic faith. I meet someone in a bar and they're like, you know, "I'm a devout Catholic because I was an altar server 20 years ago and I know it." I'm like, then I know immediately they know nothing about the Catholic faith. Because without sounding like I'm exaggerating, I think I can honestly say I'm shocked about something I learn about the Catholic faith every week. After 30 years of studying this an hour a day, there's still something, maybe not every day, but every week where I'm like, I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. I can't believe that about the Catholic faith. I mean, it's a simple enough for a child to understand, and yet someone for me who
so
obviously
profound,
is a hermit,
right,
has a lot of time to study, am always shocked.
Right.
So there has to be mystery in who you love. And I think of my grandma. She's dying 2-hour drive from here in Illinois. That mystery equals love, not absolutely everything prima facie equals love.
Right, right. No, that's deep. No, I agree. That's deep. That's deep.
Wow. Let's wrap it up with that, Rock. It's getting late here in Chicago. Thanks so much for joining us.
No, we have to do this again some more, man.
Great night.
We'll talk about shooting some bad guys.
Sounds good. God bless
you. All right. Thank you, Padre.
Have a great night.